Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And this was a damn interesting week. So let's get started with our first link.
First link.
All right, from The Guardian. Wild chimpanzees have been filmed by scientists bonding over alcoholic fruit. Let me be clear. The scientists were not bonding over alcoholic fruit. They were filming the chimpanzees who were doing the bonding.
It's very voyeuristic, if you ask me.
I mean, most of Western science, let's be real. But footage of apes consuming fermented breadfruit in particular, it's leading researchers to ask if it may shed light on the origins of human feasting. The researchers were led by scientists from the University of Exeter in the UK. It was in Guinea-Bissau's Cantanhes National Park. There's a little bit of a looping gif where you can see some chimpanzees going through fruit. For humans, we know that drinking alcohol leads to a release of dopamine and endorphins, resulting feelings of happiness, relaxation. And we also know that sharing alcohol, including through traditions like feasting, can help to form and strengthen social bonds. That's Anna Boland from the Center for Ecology and Conservation at Exeter's campus. Now, with the footage we have, we know that wild chimpanzees are eating and sharing ethanolic fruits. The question is, could they be getting similar benefits? And the reason this is important is because chimps do not share food all of the time. So this behavior with fermented fruit stood out as something that might be important. They used motion-activated cameras, the researchers did, to film chimpanzees sharing the large, dense, and fibrous fermented fruit. They tested the fruit for alcohol content, and the highest level detected was 0.61%, which isn't much. But despite the alcohol level being low, they sure ate a lot of the fruit quantity-wise every day. So it would have been a fair amount, maybe comparable to sipping on a light beer throughout the whole day.
Mm-hmm.
The names they gave the chimpanzees were kind of amazing. So they had two adult males, Manjambe and Gary. They were observed approaching breadfruit with aggressive stances. Manjambe claimed a piece and began to feed. But then another adult male, Bobby, kept Gary at bay. In the end, they all had a taste of the ripe breadfruit within the vicinity.
Yeah, I mean, that's another thing they have in common with humans is that someone's always got to hold back Gary. Like, he can't be trusted. You can't let Gary in.
Damn it, Gary. Yeah. Not again.
You know what? If SpongeBob has taught me anything, every species has a Gary.
That's right.
But at the very least, the author of the study did say that the number of observations was small, but they could lead to an explosion of research into the topic.
Well, and they can fund it by just putting it on YouTube.
Oh, yeah. Brought to you by Budweiser. Hello.
Just hysterical.
Yeah, I mean, I remember that one video of the leopard getting high, and I would click on that content a lot.
Oh, my gosh. We're going to need a lot of animal communicators to ensure consent over here. Okay, next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from Ars Technica. It's titled, Bone Collector Caterpillar Adorns Itself in Insect Body Parts.
Cool.
Does it have a metal band named after it yet? Because it should.
Yeah. So the photos in this article are pretty interesting. If you don't like bugs or dead bug body parts on other bugs, you might not want to look at it, but I've pretty much described exactly what it looks like. I mean, this caterpillar looks kind of like a crawling trash heap made of horrors. Anyways, I'll jump in. So we think of moths and butterflies as we think of moths.
Sorry.
Let me start over.
Start to jump.
We think of moths and butterflies as relatively harmless creatures, but there are certain species with a darker side, such as carnivorous caterpillars that eat aphids, butterflies that drink alligator tears, or vampire moths that feed on livestock blood. Add to that list the newly discovered bone collector caterpillar, which conducts daring raids on spider webs for sustenance, camouflaging itself in the body parts of already consumed insects to avoid being eaten.
Mm.
According to a new paper published in the journal Science, The caterpillars can tailor those insect parts, nibbling away at any excess material to ensure a proper fit. Daniel Rubinoff, an entomologist at the University of Hawaii Manoa, studies a genus of moths found in Hawaii called Hyposcoma, or as he has dubbed their larval form, Hawaiian fancy case caterpillars, so named because they spin their own casings, adding to them as they grow, although the materials used can vary widely. There are now more than 600 species within this genus, many of them not yet officially described, so it was a rich research area to explore. The discovery of the bone collector species was serendipitous. Rubinoff told Ars, "You never forget your first bone collector." His team was on Oahu looking for Hyposcoma when they came across a little tree hollow and spotted something at the bottom that at first glance just looked like a bag of bug bits. The caterpillar then stuck its head out, and the researchers realized it was a new kind of case. Rubinoff assumed that the spider web also found in the tree hollow was a coincidence, but then the team started finding more of these caterpillars, all covered in the body parts of other insects and shed spider skins, and all in the vicinity of spider webs.
It strikes me that this is like the zombie trope, where you have to rub yourself in dead zombie to avoid the scent of the zombie.
Yeah. Like,
this is awesome. I think he's a very clever caterpillar.
Even traditions of like indigenous warriors carrying skulls to adorn themselves and, you know, mark themselves as warriors.
Yeah. I mean, it's like a teardrop tattoo for a caterpillar, for sure. So, Rubinoff, who spent several years verifying that this was indeed a rare new species, said, "We started realizing these things are only hanging out where there are spiders." A genomic analysis confirmed the researcher's suspicion and shed some light on the bone collector's possible evolutionary pathway. The bone collector may have only just been discovered by humans, but it's at least 5 million years old and possibly as old as 12 million years, predating the island of Oahu, on which it now exclusively resides in an area of about 15 square kilometers in the Waianae Mountains. No other known member of the same lineage has yet been found, suggesting that the species originated on an early island in a chain that has since subsided. But why do the caterpillars do this? Rubinoff says, "It's a decorate or die situation." In evolutionary history, the ones that didn't decorate their cases were probably removed from the gene pool pretty quickly, but a few of them started incorporating bug and spider bits in their cases and survived. If you're going to live in Smog's lair, you'd better look like treasure. And it's a jumbled up, messy kind of treasure, since arranging the body parts into orderly a fashion would defeat the purpose of camouflage as they crawl around the three-dimensional cobwebs they favor. The next step is to take a closer look at the caterpillar genome to find an underlying mechanism for this unusual behavior, as well as details on how the caterpillars can distinguish between bug bits and, say, dirt, and how they're able to perceive size for tailoring purposes. A bone collector can be quite selective, picking up potential body parts among the web detritus and probing them with its mandibles, chewing larger pieces down to the desired size. Nor will the caterpillars accept other materials when they spin their cases. It's the discarded corpses of their enemies or nothing, even in captivity.
Wow.
Rubinoff has already brought several into the lab where the caterpillars can gorge themselves on Drosophila pupae with no fear of spiders interrupting the feast. This confirmed that bone collectors are no mere scavengers, they're predatory, chewing right through the silk to eat the live pupae. They'll even cannibalize each other, which is why you don't see more than one at each spider web, says Rubinoff. The clock is ticking, however, as the bone collector is extremely rare and in danger of extinction due to the large number of invasive species, especially non-native ants and parasitic wasps, that have found their way to Hawaii. And that's where the article ends. Really fascinating little creature. I mean, kind of crazy to think that it's literally in 15 square kilometers and that's it.
Mm-hmm. Well, to them, that's a whole universe.
Right. True. And at some point, you end up with like an Inception situation where the bone caterpillar dies and something else uses that as its camouflage, but it's still got the layer. I mean, I'm just saying it goes all the way down.
That's how you get insect Mad Max.
I mean, honestly, Mad Max is not a bad description for how these things look. Like, truly, the crazy vehicle outfitting, like, it's like that, but dead bugs.
Cool.
Yeah. Next link.
Next link.
Okay, this comes from Discover. Friends at first sniff. Smell preferences predict people's friendship potential. While many scientists have studied how olfactory cues inform romantic situations, few have looked at how they influence us in platonic scenarios. Moreover, while the majority of social olfactory studies have concentrated on our, quote, natural odors, only a few have focused on diplomatic odors or the signature scents that are shaped by our daily choices.
So, like, I change my deodorant and all my friends drop me. And it's not because I suddenly smell stinky. It's just because I smell different.
Yeah, they don't like the way you smell anymore.
Yeah.
So, hoping to address these gaps in research, a team at Cornell set out to determine how diplomatic scents inform platonic interactions between strangers. Enlisting the help of 40 heterosexual participants, all of whom were women ages 18 to 30, the researchers asked the participants to take part in a series of, quote, speed-friending interaction sessions, which to me sounds like a nightmare.
I don't know. It feels competitive to me, which could be fun. It's like speed chess. Who won this friend interaction? I did, baby.
So before and after, they evaluated the scents of the other participants by sniffing their previously worn t-shirts. After each of these steps, the first t-shirt smell test, the short face-to-face interaction sessions, and the second t-shirt test, the participants were asked to judge their friendship potential with other participants. The team found that the judgments in the pre-interaction smell assessments predicted the judgments in the post-interaction conversation assessments. However, the researchers also revealed that the participants' perceptions of conversation quality predicted their perceptions of scent after the interaction. So I guess if the conversation is bad enough.
Yeah, I mean, to a certain degree, you've now associated that smell with this person you don't like, and you can pick up on it when you smell the shirt again and be like, ah, no, I hated that person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and unsurprisingly, they found that nobody wanted to be friends with the shirt that smelled like Axe body spray.
Right, exactly.
So according to the researchers, the participants' preferences for particular people's scents were also relatively individualistic.
Yeah, well, and you can, I'm sure if you go back and look, there's probably some like, oh, this person actually smells closer to what your mother smelled like when you were a kid. Like that stuff can get super ingrained.
Not only that, but I don't know how they removed the pheromone from the t-shirt, right? Like there has to be some pheromone in the shirt that they wore. But for now, it seems safe to say that finding friends may be more of an olfactory process than traditionally thought.
We have to keep showering is what I'm hearing. Like, there's not a choice. You
please,
have to.
Please keep showering.
Yeah.
Next link.
Next link.
All right. Well, I've got a fun one from XKCD's What If series called What If the Sun Suddenly Went Out?
That's not
fun. Okay.
Yeah. Obviously, the short answer is we'd be dead next link. But the bread and butter of this series is looking at aspects of strange questions that you might not have thought about precisely because your mind is immediately drawn to the obvious conclusion. So, what are some of the lesser known benefits of the sun ceasing to function? Well, first off, we'd have massive improvements in the field of astronomy. Without the sun, ground-based observatories would be able to operate around the clock. And on top of that, the colder atmosphere would be thinner and more stable, which would cause less atmospheric noise that our optic systems currently have to filter out. Number two, we'd get improved satellite service. Currently, when a communication satellite passes in front of the sun, it can drown out the satellite's radio signal, causing a blind spot. Deactivating the sun would technically solve this problem. Number three, we would have vastly improved trade systems around the world because, as it stands, we are diurnal creatures who have had to create time zones so that everyone gets to be awake during their own daytime. And anyone who's had to have a meeting with somebody on the other side of the world knows that it does cause a lot of inefficiencies when your work hours don't overlap. But if there were no such thing as daytime anymore, we could slowly shift everyone to a universal planetary time, which would vastly improve business communications. We would also, number four, see a reduced risk of damage from solar flares. And unlike some of the rarer natural disasters like, you know, major volcanoes erupting, solar flares are actually a real concern to our modern world. In 1859, a massive solar flare, which is to say a geomagnetic storm, hit the Earth, and the principles of electromagnetism meant that every electrical wire on the planet suddenly experienced a massive current flowing through it. Now, in 1859, this meant that a bunch of telegraph wires were damaged and many of them spontaneously caught on fire. So it's pretty easy to imagine how much worse that problem would or will be now that we have so many more electrical wires circling the Earth.
You know that, like, Spain and Portugal had, like, a blackout completely yesterday, right?
No, this is a real thing that definitely could happen. And they say if the 1859 solar flare hit today, it's estimated that the economic damage for the United States alone would be several trillion dollars, which is more than the cost of every hurricane that's ever hit us combined. As a bonus, in a sunless world, we'd also be safe from hurricanes because the ocean would be frozen. Benefit number five, infrastructure savings, specifically when it comes to bridges. The Department of Transportation estimates that it costs about $20 billion per year just to repair and maintain all the bridges currently in the United States. But if all lakes and rivers are frozen, we can abandon most of those bridges and just drive right over the ice. Number six, safer babies? This one's a little strange to me, but apparently, according to health experts, babies under 6 months old should be kept out of direct sunlight at all times. Which, like, I get that you don't want to sunburn your baby, but no direct sunlight, even for a second, it sounds a little extreme. I feel like that's just asking for a vitamin D deficiency, which vitamin D would, by the way, definitely be a problem in a world without sun. But it is true that we wouldn't have to worry about babies getting too much sun. Even more of a stretch, number seven, you could argue that we'd have safer air travel because there is a phenomenon known as the photic sneeze reflex, which is where bright sunlight makes some people sneeze. I don't know if y'all get that. I used to when I was younger, but it hadn't happened in a long time. It's not very well understood, but we do know there's a genetic component to it. And theoretically, it could be an unsafe condition if a pilot were constantly sneezing anytime they flew east or west above the cloud cover.
I don't think that's happening.
Yeah, that person just doesn't get to be a pilot. But in this new world, they could be if they wanted to. And finally, safer parsnips. Wild parsnip plants contain a chemical called furocoumarin, and if you happen to brush against the plant and get some on your skin, it can then react with sunlight to cause severe chemical burns known as phytophotodermatitis, which we've actually talked about before on the podcast under the more common name margarita burns, because as that name implies, furocoumarins are actually in a lot of different foods, including limes, but also carrots and cumin and many others. It's pretty clear that Randall Monroe chose parsnips for this example because it's a funnier word. Nonetheless.
Right. But can it grow without sunlight?
No.
So that one should have just been left off. That one should have been left off.
None of these things are real.
I know, but that one was like, well, there's not going to be any plants, man. So why even bring
this
up plants?
This is a really great exercise in the power of framing.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, I guess it's less skin cancer.
Exactly.
Well, in a world without sun, you can look forward to less skin.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
So,
eventually, everyone would be the same color.
Oh, no. We've solved racism, guys.
There you go.
All we gotta do is ditch the sun. There you go.
For like 300,000 years, and we're good to go.
Instant death also solves all social problems.
Oy, oy, oy.
All right, next link.
Next link.
All right, we're going back to the bones. Specifically with Smithsonian Magazine, these massive monuments hosted community gatherings where prehistoric people mingled, feasted, and buried their dead. Because really, what's a party without the dead?
Exactly.
So we are going to Ireland, where their lush green landscapes are dotted with Stone Age tombs. Some of these burial sites date back to 5,000 years. And for a long time, archaeologists have puzzled over these graves. Who was buried in them? What role did they play? Now we have some answers, thanks to some new analysis of ancient DNA and archaeological data. And it suggests that these passage tombs of Ireland, these are large circular mounds with narrow entrances, they likely served as community gathering spaces. And if you're thinking of something that's kind of like a supersized hobbit situation, you're not off.
Wait, a supersized hobbit is just a person. Like, well, is it a defining characteristic of a hobbit that they're a small person?
Let me revise that. Supersized hobbit dwelling. Because is a communal gathering. So it's like, it's a Paleolithic hobbit house. It's got a round roof. It's lined with rocks, a tiny little entrance. I mean, the inspiration is very clear.
Mm-hmm.
So not only are they figuring out that these monuments were more than just about the burial, it was about like the whole architecture really seemed fit for ceremony, facilitating ongoing interaction. And they even found out that for centuries afterwards, people would enter the tomb, take bones out, put more bones in. Not only that, they found out that most of the individuals that had been buried in these Neolithic passage tombs, they were only distantly related. For example, they may have been second cousins or great-great-grandparents. Only the smaller and earlier Neolithic tombs contained the remains of closely related family members. That's kind of the bombshell here, because it contradicts the long-held assumption that these passage tombs were reserved for members of an elite ruling family, including some that had incestuous relationships. Very Game of Thrones, right? Mm-hmm. Instead, the co-authors are actually saying, no, 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 these were built for the community.
Maybe. I mean, it could have still been the elite, just not an elite family. They could have had a democracy. They could have been changing their leaders.
That's true. And that does sort of account for more fluid and flexible modes. That it was more community-oriented seems to be the big shift here. Mm. And you could argue that the nobility make a community of their own, right? Mm-hmm. But it's a lot less separated, insulated than we had been assuming for a really long time. So even though these individuals buried in the passage tombs were not close family members, they were more closely related to each other than like the wider Irish and British population at the time. That's what the DNA analysis says. So what the researchers are suspecting is that individuals formed a genetic cluster with other people who congregated at the passage tombs. Researchers found no evidence to suggest that marriages were based on status or rank, which isn't to say that wasn't possible, just didn't see the evidence. But what we did see, people met, mingled, had children with each other throughout the Irish Neolithic period, regardless of how they buried their dead.
Well, and it could also be, you said they're putting bones in and taking bones out. They could have also taken back out the ones they liked better. And these are all just like the social pariahs that nobody had any interest of hanging out with at the feast.
I'm so surprised the article got this far without mentioning anything that had to do with religion. Like, they talk about ceremony, they talk about dead, but I'm excited to see where this goes because communal parties with the dead, gotta bring those back, hello.
That's right. Set up the full skeleton in the chair next to you and take all his drinks because he doesn't need them.
I just want to be stuffed and put in the corner.
Just full taxidermy.
Weekend at Bradley's. Next link.
Next link.
We're going to stay in the realm of bones with this one. So this article comes to us from The Guardian. It's titled "Bite Marks on York Skeleton Reveal First Evidence of Gladiators Fighting Lions."
Oh my god.
Oh, I thought it was going to say gladiator bite marks. I was like, oh, yeah. They're fighting each other?
I mean, that would not surprise me. That seems like something
that
definitely
happened. But no, the lions
happened.
Is also a well-known trope. Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
If human bite marks don't tend to last on bodies as well, right?
That's a good point. Yeah, we rarely get down to the bone with our teeth. So bite marks from a lion on a man's skeleton excavated from an 1,800-year-old cemetery on the outskirts of York provide the first physical evidence of human-animal combat in the Roman Empire, new research claims. While clashes between combatants, big cats, and bears are described and depicted in ancient texts and mosaics, there had previously been no convincing proof from human remains to confirm that these skirmishes formed part of Roman entertainment. Excavation at the Driffield Terrace burial site near New York City Center began more than 20 years ago and uncovered about 80 decapitated skeletons. Most belonged to well-built young men and bore signs of brutal violence, leading experts to suspect they had uncovered a gladiator graveyard. One of the skeletons, belonging to a man aged 26 to 35, was buried in a grave with two others and overlaid with horse bones. The remains showed puncture marks on the pelvis. However, it took years of extensive work to confirm the injuries were inflicted by a large carnivore. The researchers scoured clinical and forensic literature for descriptions of bite marks made by various animals, but found little on the big cats Romans might have encountered. So they teamed up with zoos in Britain, which had provided them with horse bones that had been chewed by cheetahs, lions, tigers, and leopards for comparison. The bite marks on the man's hip matched those made by lions, but big cats typically kill by biting their prey's head or neck. Professor Tim Thompson, an anthropologist at Maynooth University in Ireland, said, "The pelvis is unusual. You can survive that injury. It's not fatal. We think the individual had been incapacitated and that these marks are evidence of the animal dragging the body away. The man might have been fatally injured in combat before he was seized by the animal," he added. Roman gladiators typically fought each other, but other combatants known as bestiarii would take on dangerous and exotic animals as part of the games. Dr. John Pierce, an archaeologist, said York doubled as a Roman town and legionary fortress at the time. "These may be gladiators who trained in a gladiatorial school at York linked to the Roman legion based there." If the researchers are right, their discovery raises questions about where gladiators fought their battles. An arena probably exists beneath the city of York, but uncovering it will not be easy. so many old buildings are preserved, you can't do the excavations underneath them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not the only mystery that remains. Thompson adds, we now know that these events happened in the provinces of the Roman Empire, but it raises other questions. For example, how do you get a lion from Africa to York?
On a boat?
Yeah. That one might be a little easier to figure out than some of the other ones. But yeah, yeah, pretty fascinating. Like, I'm glad I didn't have to have a moment where I was like, wait, there weren't actually lions? And then realizing, no, there were really lions.
Right. You could just skip that bit.
Yeah. I was just blissfully unaware. And now it's confirmed. So that's nice.
Yeah. Because I was under the impression that they didn't fight, that the lions and tigers ate the slaves that were there. But like, I'll stop.
Well, there could definitely be other angles to it. Like, oh, we only fed the punishable ones to the lions. Or correct, these were only for prisoners. You know, because they said, oh, they're nice and strong. But kind of everybody was strong back then. You mm-hmm. know, you had to walk everywhere. It was very buffeting.
Yeah.
Next link.
Next link.
Okay. 99% effective. First hormone-free male birth control pill enters human trials.
Oh, nice. At last.
YCT-529, a hormone-free male birth control pill, has shown high effectiveness in animals and is now in human trials. So, the FDA has approved more than 20 types of contraceptives. Only two options currently exist for men: condoms, vasectomies.
Mm-hmm.
However, research from the University of Minnesota College of Pharmacy, published in Communications Medicine, has paved the way for the first hormone-free male birth control pill to reach clinical trials. Developed in partnership with Columbia University and Your Choice Therapeutics. So that explains the YCT-529.
Oh, okay.
I don't want to know what 528 does.
But they have said hormone-free repeatedly because they know their audience.
Yeah.
Exactly. 529 prevents pregnancy by inhibiting sperm production. In male mice, the drugs caused infertility and was 99% effective in preventing pregnancies within 4 weeks of use. Mm. In male non-human primates, the drug lowered sperm counts within 2 weeks of starting the drug. But this is the most important thing, y'all. Both mice and non-human primates fully regained fertility after stopping the drug. Mice regained fertility within 6 weeks and non-human primates within about 10 to 15 weeks. And no side effects from the drugs were detected in either group.
Wow. Jeez.
So if you don't regain your fertility for 10 to 15 weeks, that also makes it sound like if you screw up and miss a pill, you're still basically okay.
Because
like with female birth control, you miss one day, your month is probably shot. But if this one is like, okay, I screwed up today, but I can still keep going and I'm not at risk, that's also hugely improved over female birth control pills.
Absolutely.
Now, what is the adoption going to look like? Because I am skeptical and pessimistic.
Yeah.
Sure.
Because even a hint of, potential infertility, like masculinity and virility, I don't know. This seems like
it depends on the man. It completely depends on the man.
Sure, that's true. Of course. Yeah.
So the next steps are underway. The research established that YCT-529 was suitable for human studies, and a phase one clinical trial for the drug was completed successfully in 2024. The drug is currently undergoing safety and efficacy testing trials. So, all right, you guys ready for the bad news?
Sure.
Okay.
The research was supported by the NIH.
No.
Oh.
Are you about to tell me this whole thing's been canceled?
I'm going to guess it's going to be canceled, considering that we're looking for a era of make more babies. What's the first thing that's going to get killed? Sorry,
all right,
guys.
Well, cool.
Yeah.
But that's the reality of today that we're living in.
Listen, there's going to be a thriving black market. I'm confident. I'll be running it, if nothing else. So.
Right. I'll join you.
All right. Well, that is all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Some of the articles we did not have time to get to today include, is this the first hint of Planet Nine? Testosterone doesn't do what you think it does. And Mark Zuckerberg says social media is over. So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today, can be found on DamnInteresting.com. If you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at patreon.com/DamnInteristingWeek. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Waisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.